Today, why what we want least is often what we need most.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
In particular today, I want to apply that idea, which in some ways is inherently true. In some ways. I'm not saying it would be true in a different world, but I am saying in the real world where we live, a fallen world, a world where we are not perfect, very often what we want least is what we need most. And I want the focus today of that concept or that irony to be about faith, the concept of faith itself, which is what we'll be talking about today. But the application of it goes way beyond that, and I would even say it's sort of it's the basis of a whole set of shows or episodes that we have done on the podcast since we got started. Previous episodes we've done on this topic that you can find at barrycreamer.com or, you know, wherever you're downloading your podcasts anyway. If you go back to the beginning of the episodes, we had episode 5 was Finding You by Seeing Others. Episode 8 was The Problem with Others is That They Are Also People. Episode 20, even a scripture show that we did on James 5 about your personal faith, how personal is your faith, is the same thing. That the thing that we, and in this case, I'm not talking about faith in this case, but community, as an illustration of how pervasive this irony is, the irony that what we want least is what we need most. Community is an example of that. Now, I'm not going to rehash all the things that we talked about in those episodes about community. Not today. I'll probably rehash them regularly for the rest of my life. But for today, that's not the goal. But simply to remind you of this reality, that the thing that's most valuable about being part of a community is the part of it that drags out of you what would be missing if you were by yourself. It's not just what they give you that you want, it's what they give you that you need. And a part of the reason you need it is because you won't pursue it on your own. That's the nature of us as individuals. We create around us these cocoons of protection that allow us to have the things we want and avoid the things we don't want. And when we get involved in a community, they break up the cocoon. They force us to be interactive with people who drag us toward things that we normally wouldn't be interested in. Even things that once we are involved in, we realize how grateful we are to have received. So I'm not saying that we disdain it the whole time. I'm simply saying that where we would be inclined, think about an introvert, inclined not to get up and get dressed and go do the things you need to do for the day with other people, you might decide to do that if you really are on your own. But then when you have obligations in a community, you might be furrowing your brow at them or sighing or regretting it or acting like Eeyore and all of that. But then once you get there, you realize, well, this is why I have a community, because I need someone to drag me out of my Eeyore-ish state and force me to deal with all those Pollyannas out in the world. And by dealing with them, realize that there's sunshine and air and life's okay. So the point is that very often, the thing that we want least, especially in a given moment, is the thing we need most. And the reason we don't want it is the very reason that we need it. So anyway, I'll illustrate that some with faith as we're talking about it. So the point today is to apply this irony to one of the most important elements, certainly in a religious life, obviously, but not all religions are built around the concept of faith, but the idea of faith is central to most of the religions that we would identify with, and certainly to Christianity. faith is central. So faith is, and I will sort of reorganize, rehash the same idea, that same irony, why what we want least is often what we need most, with faith in this way, that faith is as important as the reasons for not having it are valid. And that might seem like a weird statement, but that's the truth about faith. It's the nature of faith, that it is as important that we have faith is as important as the reasons we have for not having it are valid. So faith is as important as the reasons for not having it are valid. I'm not saying faith is as genuine or faith is as true as the reasons for not having it are valid. That's not the point. It's not about whether factually, objectively, you ought to hold faith. That's not the question. This is how important is your faith to you in a given moment. And the significance of your faith to you is very much shaped by the validity of the reasons you have for abandoning that faith or for never holding it to begin with. That's part of the reason faith becomes so important. If I were to take that same kind of rehashing and apply it to the community that I was talking about a moment ago, it would be this. The community is, this is how you find out how important your community is to you. Community is as important to us as the shame we are willing to bear by being a part of it. If when you are in a community and then there's pressure and you are embarrassed or shamed by that community or in some way held to account by that community and all you do is bolt, well, I'm not going to be a part of this. I don't have to put up with this. Nobody's going to treat me that way or something like that. Then you know that that was the limit of the importance of that community to you. Well, I'm not going to be embarrassed by my community, so I'll just go on my own. I don't need them, or I'll go be a part of a different community. That tells you how unimportant the community was to you. And so the limit on the value of that community to you is your willingness to bear the negative things that that community brings to you in your own emotions, in your own relationship with them. So community can be measured in its importance to you by the shame, because shame is not something we're willing to bear. I'm choosing it as sort of the pinnacle of the examples of things that would cause people to abandon something. And it is. It's sort of at the forefront. You can go back and listen to those episodes I was talking about regarding community, and you'll understand what I mean by it, that community is as important to us as the shame we're willing to bear by being a part of it. That's how you know how important it is. And you don't have to be shamed by your community for it to have value to you. You don't have to have that, but you would learn the importance of your community by knowing what that boundary is, what that limit of shame would be. And I'm saying the same thing about your faith. It's not like your faith isn't real just because you're not facing a crisis of your faith right now. I'm not saying that at all. Again, I'm not dealing with the objective reality, the existence of a person's faith. I'm dealing with how important it is to you, how significant it is to you in this moment. And faith is as important as the reasons you have for not holding it are valid. So here's what I mean by this. When we talk about faith, it means so many different things. Let me just clarify the term for a few minutes. First of all, regarding the nature of faith, there are two different ways of talking about it. One has to do with the origin of faith. Genetic faith is how I often refer to it. That moment of beginning. So the sort of think of the word Genesis, the genesis of faith in a person. That initial faith has one form. And then there is persistent faith, which is built into the word. So it's not like we can just pick and choose between these two. These are both elements of faith. Part of the elements, one of the elements of faith is how you adopt it. Okay, so I'm going to believe this. I become a believer, a faither. The word belief and the word faith are almost interchangeable, even in English. They are certainly interchangeable in Greek. I mean, it's the same word. So here, the idea that initial faith is different from persistent faith doesn't mean that there are really two different entities, ontological entities in the universe, one faith like this, one faith like that. But the experience we have of faith is different. The opening moment of faith, that moment when, and there are a couple of different options on how to come at that opening moment of faith. And that's the understatement of the century. There are boundless options. I have no idea how many there are. But there are two very significant ones. One is sort of a psychological default. And that is the idea that you come to faith in the things that you just happen to learn are true. So now I believe in Christianity because I saw all the evidence, and now I realize, well, sure enough, Christ did rise from the dead. So of course I'm a Christian because I realized that Christ rose from the dead. So now I believe in the resurrection, and I'm a believer. That idea of believing because of a psychological default that your mind automatically adopts a faith stance, a belief stance toward the things which you now know, which is a reasonable thing to say, by the way. If you know something, you certainly believe it. It would be really hard to conceive of somebody saying, yes, I know that George Washington was the first president, but I don't believe it. That doesn't make any sense. If you know something, obviously you believe it. And that's all that some people think of faith, that if I can come to know something, then of course I'll believe in it. And so I've talked to people before. I witnessed to a man a few years back who, as an engineer with a science and engineering background and as a professional engineer from an atheistic background in his community, he was not closed to hearing the gospel, and I shared it with him. But at the end of talking to him about the gospel, he just said, I wouldn't mind believing in that, but I just don't have enough evidence that any of that is what's true. And when I talked to him about a different definition of what faith could be, rather than simply a default acknowledgement of your mind to the things that you already know, then he reconsidered, and he actually did exercise faith. Different matter. I'll come to it in a moment. But that psychological default, that way of thinking of the mind as just functioning toward faith, is one way people think about it. You'll see why this is important later in the discussion when we start talking more about how, and think of it this way, that people come to moments of crisis and people do abandon their faith, for instance, and become doubters or cynics instead of believers. And why would they do that? And the answer is because there are a lot of reasons not to have faith. If you think there aren't, then you're describing a huge portion of the world, which doesn't have faith, as if it's necessarily irrational. They're not irrational. There are lots of reasons not to have faith. That's why faith is so important, which is what we're trying to get to in the conversation. When we get to that part of the conversation, you'll see why it's important to recognize the difference between understanding faith as sort of a psychological default and understanding faith, and I will take the extreme form here. It doesn't have to be this extreme, but sort of a Kierkegaardian extreme form. For those of you who know Kierkegaard, it's fine. If you don't, you'll get it in just a second. Of more of a leap, that you take the leap of faith, the idea of unfounded trust. Not that you wouldn't have any grounding for it at all, but that to the extent you can't prove it, to the extent you don't know it, but it seems like something you really ought to trust, for some reason you've got this urge to trust it, that's what faith is, that it's a leap. And this is that's the idea behind sort of an existential or a fideist view on faith, on coming to faith, as we're talking now just about that initial faith that a person has, that moment when they make a choice that I'm going to believe in something, or if you take the psychological default view, that they simply now find themselves believing something that they didn't believe before. That idea of adopting an unfounded trust is, and that's the way we use the word faith in this context, is as trust. So I put my trust in this person, in Jesus Christ, as my Savior, and so on. And I'm completely comfortable with that statement and with inviting people to make that statement. I'm much more inclined toward this side. You can probably tell just by the discussion. Both sides have good arguments to make, and there are believers, fine Christian believers, on both sides of this understanding of genetic faith, where faith comes from. But I'm on the leap side. I am definitely on the side. Not that it has to be a blind leap, but that you have a genuine option and that you have to make a decision about following Christ or trusting him. But regardless, faith in anything can take that form where you are adopting this leap, where you are exercising, and we'll just use those words for convenience, unfounded trust. This idea of approaching it as a leap requires this commitment. What you're doing is making a commitment to a genuine option. So now I'm using the words of William James instead of Kierkegaard. And the idea behind this, that you are making a commitment to a genuine option from William James, is that you sometimes in life are brought to a position where you are at a fork in the road and you have to decide, am I going to be a theist or an atheist? Am I going to be a theist or an agnostic? Or it may be about something completely different than that. Am I going to take this job or that job? Am I going to move to California or to New York? Which sounds catastrophic to some of you and sounds like heaven to some of you. But the idea is, if Texas were falling off the map for some reason and suddenly you had to move, the idea behind William James's argument that you might have to make a choice between genuine options and not really have enough information to know which choice to make is that you might be forced into that kind of a situation. So, what am I going to do? I've only got two places I can go, this way or that way. If I go this way, there are dangers ahead, but there are also benefits. And if I go that way, dangers ahead, also benefits. What am I going to do? Sometimes you have to make a choice. It's a necessary commitment that you're going to have to make between genuine options. You know New York exists. You know California exists. People talk about it. There's enough information that you believe there might be something at the end of I-30 and at the end of I-20 or I-10 or whatever it becomes out that way. The point is that you look at it and go, all right, I got to make a choice. And for William James, if that choice is living, forced, and momentous between genuine options, then it might be the expression of this kind of faith choice that you make. And by the way, that all of that has to do with the will to believe, and it's related to Blaise Pascal's wager, if you know Pascal's wager. None of that's important to 90% of you, but to a few of you, you understand what I was just talking about, and you might want to go look up Pascal's wager and go, how did William James come back to Pascal's wager and say it actually did make sense or defend it? Because it's quite an interesting historical discussion that we don't have time for today. The point is that now we've got a way of understanding faith in terms of its initiation. It might just be that psychological default that some people talk about. It might be a leap of unfounded trust or a necessary commitment that other people would talk about. The other side of faith, the persistent side of faith, the side that requires tenacity, where day after day, week after week, month after year, and so on, you actually hold this faith, also has two different forms. And they're parallel to the ones we were just talking about. I'll come at them in the opposite direction because I think that's how they relate. One is that faith every day is another new leap in your commitment to following whatever it is you've adopted. And in this case, I'd be talking about Christianity, for example. So it's sort of an iterative leaping, you know? So you take the leap of faith and you say, oh, I did it. I trusted. I took the leap. I believed in the thing, you know? And then the next morning you wake up and you go, okay, am I going to do it again? Am I going to continue down this road of faith? Am I going to keep doing this? And you have to leap again. So there is a sense of validity with that. I die daily, you know, that expression that if you're going to be my disciple, you have to take up your cross daily and follow me. There is a part of Christianity that sort of requires you to adopt the position that you're going to take the leap of faith every day. And I'm okay with that. C.S. Lewis deals with, I'm okay with it. I mean, I comply with Scripture. Okay, I'll agree with the Word of God. Anyway, the point is, C.S. Lewis in his book Perelandra, you know, the middle book in his science fiction trilogy, which if you've never read is just fantastic. I mean, it's just so much fun. Horrible science fiction in terms of science. But, oh, so good in terms of its theological underpinnings and the way of exploring these theological ideas in a really fascinating context anyway. Perelandra, you know, the middle book in that, and I'm not going into any details here. There is a tiny bit of a spoiler if you haven't read it at all, but not much. And I would say it's worth giving away just so you'd go read the book. But the Eve character in the Perelandra story, she says no to the temptation at first, and this is the spoiler part. But then, you know, finally, the main character, the ransom character in the story, sort of the Christ figure in the story, sort of a messianic figure, not Christ himself, but the messianic figure in the story, he actually sees her having to say no every day to the demon that's tempting her to do this. Violate this supreme command on this planet. The point is that when he realizes, C.S. Lewis writes about it so that we'll get the idea that finally the ransom character realizes that it's not necessary for a person to have to say no to the same temptation every single day. At some point, You should end the temptation. At some point, it should go away. Now, all I'm doing is just trying to point out that that way of conceiving of faith that requires a daily renewal isn't irrational and does have some grounding in the Christian life. There is an other side to it, though, that I think is more fundamental to how Christianity persists in a believer, and therefore, in this case, I'm talking more broadly about how faith persists in a person who holds it. And that really does actually fit more in line with the psychological default that goes with how we believe things. But I hold this view, by the way, just in case you're curious about it, which I doubt, but you might be, and now I'm going to impose it on you anyway. But I hold this view precisely because I think you have to make that initial step into faith. But after you make that initial step, the idea of the tenacity of belief, which is a psychological characteristic that we all have, that once you adopt a belief, you have a certain tenacity in that belief. You have a certain desire to hold on to that belief. Otherwise, we'd be so unstable. I mean, we just couldn't function from moment to moment. You have a tenacity of belief in gravity, for instance, and the way it works on the Earth that allows you to walk around without panicking between each step that you're about to fly off the planet again. Your tenacity of belief is just inherent to your psychology, and it's a part of our inductive nature as human beings, that we reason inductively and naturally. Anyway, I would love to just dive off and start talking about epistemology here, the study of knowledge and how we work and come to know things and so on. But my point is this, simply this, that I think the position that once you adopt a faith in something, regardless of which way you came to it, through the psychological default or the leap, it becomes the psychological default that you would continue to believe that. It doesn't mean that it can't be knocked loose, and it doesn't mean that some of your faith might be held so loosely that it does have to be adopted every day, that any of that could be the case. But it would be normal, the default in your psychology, to adopt a belief and then to continue to hold that belief. This is why, by the way, people who hear a news story will often adopt the view of whoever's reporting to them, even if the person is on a diatribe. Even if the person is simply pandering to some one-sided audience, they will hear the news story, and then that becomes the truth. And it doesn't matter what the second news story they hear is. The second news story becomes suspect the moment it says something different than the first news story. That's a psychological default for us. This is what I heard. Oh, lo and behold, this is how things turned out in the last election. And then what we hear from then on is shaded or jaded by that first report. This is how the psychology regarding the tenacity of faith or tenacity of belief works. But it's just our nature as human beings. Otherwise, again, we wouldn't be able to hold any consistency at all. The thing that breaks this are anomalies. When things are out of place, and again, I could pause here and we could have a long conversation about existentialism and the nature of existentialism. If you've ever watched a movie like The Truman Show, the light that falls out of the ceiling, out of the sky, if you ever saw The Truman Show, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But when that light falls out of the sky and he's looking at it, that's an anomaly. When you look at it and you go, where on earth did this come? What's going on? What happened here? How could this happen? It starts to break down the system that you've constructed that makes sense of the faith that you hold. So when anomalies show up, they become a reason for us to say, wait, maybe the things I believe aren't true. Maybe something's gone wrong here, and that's why we're having the conversation, because anomalies always come. Not because the world is so broken. That's true, too. The world is so broken that sometimes we're confronted by the anomalies that come with a fallen world. But anomalies come because we're so imperfect in our knowledge. So obviously, if I don't have a perfect knowledge of everything, then the model that I construct, the narrative I construct in my mind for comprehending things and putting them in their appropriate places is imperfect. And if it's imperfect, then it's easy for me to discover a new bit of data and realize, oh, I told that part of the story wrong. The bear didn't go outside of the home and then go off into the woods. It went outside of the home and hibernated over in that cave over there. Lo and behold, I just didn't know that little bit of truth. very often anomalies can be made to consort. They can fit together, comport with the rest of the narrative that we've told or the rest of the way you understand the world. But sometimes anomalies are significant enough that they make us back up and really doubt the things that are going on around us. And if you are not dealing with this in your own life, you should pay attention to the people around you who are dealing with it in their lives, because anomalies regarding faith are everywhere right now, huge, and impacting entire denominations and the way people are relating to each other, as well as generations and how they're relating to faith in general. The idea of being a nun, not Shakespeare run off to a nunnery, but, you know, being an N-O-N-E in response to these polls where people say, what faith are you? None. Is evidence of what anomalies have done to an entire generation that's coming up right now. And again, I'm not even just going on the statistics. Statistics are important, but sometimes they can be misleading about where individuals actually are, in the same way that individual stories can be, you know, interesting, can be insightful, but also misleading about where the statistics actually are. So both are valuable. But I'm not just basing it on statistics. In my conversations with people who are in that Gen Z and following group, the idea that they have watched Christianity be purported in this way but lived in that way, that they have watched claims of this but seen that, has had a huge impact on their ability to make sense of the way faith has been presented to them. And it also goes to us as well. So let's talk about those anomalies. So obviously we can't cover every anomaly that comes into a person's life. It could happen in a parent who loses their faith for a teenager, for instance. That would be an anomaly for the teenager. What happened? My mom was going to church all the time, and then she just quit. That would shake up a person and make them think, oh, what's going on? And all those things, church leadership, having a moral failure, or anything along those lines would be an anomaly. But very often, they come in the form of just the way life plays out for people. And you can talk about it all the time, but when it actually happens to you, things change. We've all heard the stories of people who have lost their faith, abandoned their faith, rejected their faith, whatever you want to say, because something happened to them that's happened to everybody at some point in life. But when it happens to them, it becomes so personal, so challenging, that they just can't quite find their way back to the faith that they had before. And so that would be an example of an anomaly, that where that person is confronted with something so different they don't know what to do with it. So let me just give three forms of anomaly. These are not the only three. They're not all-encompassing. They're just examples, and they are examples that I've seen in people, or I've dealt with in people, or in myself, that are worth talking about in terms of then whether it is something that would cause a person to abandon their faith, or to even have more reason for holding their faith, or an exactly equivalent reason for holding their faith, which, by the way, is my case. That's the case I'm making today. Because remember, the ultimate claim we're making is that faith is as important to us as the reasons for not having it are valid to us. That's the point we're making. So here's an anomaly, an intellectual anomaly. These are pretty straightforward, and they're easier to deal with rationally because they are rational issues. So for example, and I'm going to give a very broad example here. This would be more of a cultural example than a personal or individual an example. The level of scientific success in the modern world, and I mean since the 1700s or so. So the level of scientific success in the modern world has been so profound. Science and engineering has done so much. And I'm talking about even just introducing cures to diseases and vaccinations and all of the, you know, air conditioning and airplanes, and not even to get into the atomic age, where we actually grasp something of the underlying structure of the material world and the energy that's there and so on. the unbelievable accomplishments of science in that world sort of forces that scientific success into non-material realities as well. So let me explain. I'm saying it that way because science works on the material world. You make observations about the material world, and you draw conclusions about how it works, and you hypothesize, and you experiment until your hypothesis and the result of the experiment finally fit closely enough together that you create a theory, and you live in that theory, and so on. So that way of working really only works in the material world because you have to make observations. You have to be able to measure things like with your senses, with sense data. And so, but science is so successful, we'd like to have the same kind of success we have with science with things that are less scientific, you know, things like God, where it's really hard to make a material observation about a spiritual being. And so, you know, one of two things happens. Either you incorporate that discipline into scientific methods, or you exclude that discipline from being considered real anymore. Oh, well, you can go off and do your fairy tale stuff about God if you want to, but those of us who use the scientific method and actually solve problems will stay over here on this side of the room. So that's just part of the reality of science's success. If we're going to live in a world with air conditioning, it's hard not to recognize that they're pretty good at what they do. And you can tell how much air conditioning means to me. It's a very important thing. But that fact that it encroaches on or wants to make claims about non-material realities, whether those non-material realities take the form, by the way, of rational essentials, which has nothing to do with faith whatsoever, or to do with faith and spirituality, doesn't change the fact that it's a scientific or materialistic method that's encroaching on us. And again, it's encroaching on us not for no reason, but because it's had such tremendous success. I mean, overwhelming success. We put men on the moon, for crying out loud. And you can say, yeah, but we haven't done it since 1969. You know, we did it, for crying out loud. That's enough. The point is, it's incredibly successful. Well, the degree to which we have to rely on faith, and this is nothing new. This is not a new thing. The degree to which we rely on faith for the things that are not controlled as a part of that material world and so on, can be measured, the degree to which we're relying on faith, can be measured as the extent to which science cannot be satisfied with the things that we're claiming by faith. That's the degree to which we're relying on faith. I mean, the extent to which, for instance, when people were doing studies on prayer, well, if you pray for these people, you have a 39% improvement in their recovery rate in the emergency room. When people are doing studies like that and saying, see, I can prove to you that faith is valid, you know, all a person who's outside of that realm would say is, well, you can prove that there's value in a religious community, but that can be measured materially. You can prove that there's value in religious interaction, that there's value in other people being involved in the well-being of others or whatever. To the extent that it actually is about faith, you can't prove that that's what's causing the shift in the needle in the recovery of the people who are in the ER. Now, I'm not even averse to saying people get better because you pray for them. I believe in that. I pray for people to recover. I believe people recover because I pray for them. I believe in God's power in this world, but I believe in it. It is an act of faith on my part. And I'm not put off of my faith because I can't demonstrate scientifically to someone what would not be faith by definition if I were to demonstrate it scientifically. Okay, so I'm saying all of that simply to give an example to say that when you do face an intellectual anomaly, when you face some rational question that's forced on us either by the materiality of the scientific method and all the things that go with that, or forced on us by the rational methods that go with some form of, you know, eliminative reductionism or something, whatever you're doing, whatever it is you're approaching, however you're coming at it, the extent to which your faith is what you are relying on is the part that science or rationality or whatever would not be able to be satisfied by. So it should not surprise you that there is a gap between the two. The gap is the thing that defines both sides in their existence. So just as an example, when you're facing that kind of anomaly, there is a point at which you have to back up and say, I see why that's a legitimate question, and now I understand why my response has to be a response of faith. Now you can rethink it and say, so do I still want to hold my faith? Do I still have a grounding for my faith? Because I'm not saying faith has no grounding. I'm saying faith has a grounding that's distinct from a scientific grounding or a necessarily rational grounding. That one is more arguable. It's different for reasons we can't go into right now, or we just don't have time to go into right now, but another time. Let me give you a second kind of anomaly, and one that's more, I think, practical. We'll get further down the road on the actual experience that goes with it, because I can give a couple of examples where it actually happened. So if you look historically at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century in colonial England, you know, a Christian nation, right? I get it, the difference between being born again, claiming to be Christian, blah, blah, blah. But it's still Christianity that we're talking about. People who claim to follow the Lordship of Christ, believe in the resurrection, and organize their community and their civilization around it. In that world, the Quakers, Christians, right? The Quakers, and as an outflow of that, some people in Parliament, like William Wilberforce, observe the slave trade and see something anomalous with what they understand Christianity to describe. That is, what they understand Scripture to say should be the case with believers. And this is not a complicated one. If you read Scripture honestly, it is not hard at all to condemn all forms of slavery. Old Testament forms, colonial forms, every form of slavery, absolute condemnation. The Quakers, William Wilberforce, people like that in the late 18th, early 19th century, long before it was abolished in the United States, were dealing with it in England. And they were dealing with it because they saw the hypocrisy of the Christian, I'm putting quotation marks around it, the Christian justification for slavery, which existed throughout the British Empire and in the United States. And you can say, well, you know, Christian, but it was the vast majority of Christians in the regions that actually practiced slavery who also defended and endorsed slavery. So it's not like you can say, well, you know, anybody who was just reading would have seen it. Well, all those people who were reading it didn't see it. And some who did faced an anomaly. They faced something where they had to say either something's wrong with Christianity or something's wrong with the way those people are practicing it. And in the case of William Wilberforce, the Quakers, the people who were opposing it in the British Empire, the amount of faith that was required of them was equivalent to the extent to which they were willing to become a pariah among their own people. They had to face the disdain of people who absolutely disagreed with them. And not even for spiritual reasons. People who disagreed with them for sometimes spiritual reasons, sometimes practical reasons. But the point is, they saw the anomaly and knew that they had to deal with it. Others see that same kind of moral anomaly. Oh, well, Christianity says it's this and that. But in reality, there are all these sex abuse victims. You know, what's going on with that? When people see moral anomalies like this, the one response is the prophetic response, the William Wilberforce type response. The other response is a John Rawls type response. And I don't mean to caricature John Rawls. I'm about to in some ways, not in a bad way, in a good way. But I will say, I mean, this is not a thorough dealing with a man's psychology or where he actually is, but in his writings and in the things that we know about John Rawls from the 20th century, he's an ethicist. He was pursuing a life of ministry, considering going into the priesthood himself. He wrote a significant article or thesis, maybe in his undergrad work, I can't remember, or an early grad program, I can't remember, but on Christian ministry. It was a Christian thesis. That's the idea. But when he went to war in World War II, not only seeing the anomaly of, well, here's a good God who's ruling the world, and look at all these people who are dying. And here is Christianity claiming to be the foundation of European civilization, and look at the Holocaust that's happening. This is what he saw, the Holocaust and World War II. And it shook him out of his faith, shook him out of his faith. The anomaly was significant enough that he could not see how his faith could fit with it. That doesn't make him right. I'm not saying that we should abandon our faith. I'm describing what people do in the face of such an anomaly. You may take the prophetic approach, or you might take this approach that John Rawls does, where you say, oh, I can't believe in that. What I believed in would have precluded the Holocaust. And you can say, well, it's not Christians who perpetrated the Holocaust, but remember, there was a very significant European Christian population. And I'm not just talking about Nazi fanatics, a huge Christian contingency in Europe and in the United States who justified what the Jews were going through in the Holocaust. That inexcusable behavior on the part of Christians left John Rawls saying, no, I don't think so. And later in his life, in the 60s, he's watching the Vietnam War and the draft focus on the poor and focus on people of color, and determines that there is an injustice there that's indefensible, even though even that was being defended ardently by what we would refer to now as evangelical Christianity. Not then, we wouldn't have used the word exactly the same way, but it is by those more conservative Christian circles. There's something, you know, anomalous about that. I'm not saying you adopt John Rawls's position about it, but I am saying you can understand how an anomaly like that could knock a person out of the faith that they had. In this case, faith would be equivalent to the determination to preserve your commitment to your belief in the face of a poor embodiment of that belief. It's what Jeremiah faces in Jerusalem, right? I mean, they're not living it out right. They are the people of God. They are in the covenant of God, and they're not living it out right. And he knows they're going to be punished for it. He knows they're going to be cast out for it. And so he's prophesying, and he grows so weary of it, so tired of the anomaly, that he shuts his mouth and tries to be silent about it. And when he can't be silent about it anymore, the word of God is shut up in his bones and he has to speak it out. He is preserving his faith in the face of a very poor embodiment of what that faith is supposed to look like in his community. And he takes the prophetic approach again. I wish every person would do that, but I understand that some people don't and some people can't. They just don't get there. I understand that. The point is that when there are intellectual or moral anomalies, you have a choice to make about your faith, and it's a choice that we should understand is built into the reality of faith, because you have your faith for the very reason you're going to need it when you would want to abandon it. That's why you have your faith. We are invited into faith in this world because the nature of waking up in a broken world is to say, how long is this world going to be like this? Where is God? Why is he not doing more? This is what Israel has prayed for millennia, and what God says he is going to answer for them by finally showing up. We know he's shown up in the Messiah, but even we, after the Messiah shows up, he says we're still going to be praying that. When will the kingdom of God come? And his response is, I just need you to continue to have faith. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? That's the question he asks. Finally, the emotional, relational side of this, and I won't take time to go into this in detail, but I think, you know, if you want to consider an anomaly that comes emotionally or relationally, John Feinberg's The Many Faces of Evil, which is an intellectual work, it's an academic work, but it's also very pastoral, very powerful. His wife went through a really severe disease and a long period of suffering. And in seeing that, John Feinberg, a really fine philosopher, theologian, thinker, works through all these different understandings of the theodicy, the question of evil in the world, in a book called The Many Faces of Evil. Again, if you want to understand the theodicy, I don't hold John Feinberg's theology exactly, meaning he's more reformed than I am if you just want the language of it. But wow, that book is the book on understanding the theodicy as a whole and understanding the different perspectives that come to it. But a part of it is him recognizing that people whose loved ones suffer, they face a relational or emotional crisis in their faith that doesn't have anything to do with the intellectual side. I mean, it's related, but it's not intellectual. It's not moral. It's personal. It's emotional. It's relational. And the response has to be pastoral. And in those anomalies, again, I'm going to say exactly the same thing, that the faith that you hold is exactly as important as your reason for abandoning it is real. And this is what I want to close with to make this point, that if you go through a point where you say, I don't know whether my faith is valid or whether I should continue to hold my faith or not, I'm here to tell you ahead of time, or if you're in that crisis right now, I'm telling you that your doubts are no more reason for losing faith than they are for having that faith. Very often, people become trapped in the thought that if you have an idea, you are now owned by that idea. And there is a huge difference between having an idea, for instance, a doubt, and then being owned by that idea. You can hold the idea and still hold other ideas at the same time. And being able to do that, being able to keep all those balls in the air at the same time, makes you a more mature, better, well-rounded thinker, participant in the world, believer, than one who simply suppresses those ideas to begin with. So the idea I leave you with today is very simple, and it is simply this. Doubts are no more reason for losing faith than they are for having it. My encouragement to you is, regardless of the anomalies, regardless of the doubt, that you have faith.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.